Welcome to Medicine Matters, the Springer Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Jane Gosland. We're heading into hepatology today, and we sure have a bumper edition for you this time. I'm going to start with a question. Can you define and distinguish between NAFLD, NASH, MASLD, and MASH? If your answer was like mine, unfortunately no, then do not worry. We have a fantastic expert joining us today, and he's going to walk us through it all. We're going to make sure that in less than an hour's time, you have a solid understanding of the significant changes in terminology that have happened. We look at what's changed and why, and importantly, what that means for your patients. I learned so much from this conversation. I really hope you do too.
Hello. I'm Natalie Wood, a Senior Clinical Content Manager at SpringerMedicine.com. Today, I'm delighted to be talking with Professor Vlad Ratsu about metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease and steatohepatitis, otherwise known as MASLD and MASH. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I know that many of our audience will be aware of your work, but I wondered if you could just start by telling us a little bit about how you came to be interested in MASLD and MASH and why addressing it is so important.
Yeah, it's an interesting story that, at least on a personal level, that brings me back many years ago, at the end of the past century, actually, beginning of the years 2000, when we published our first paper in 2000. That was in gastroenterology, because we realized there are people who are overweight end up having liver injury, and sometimes fibrotic liver injury, and sometimes the very advanced stages of that, which is obviously cirrhosis. And we tried to first understand a little bit of the epidemiological determinants of that. And it was a time where the concept of NASH, although it has been described more than 10 years before that, actually 20 years before that, there were very few studies around that disease. And it increased in terms of recognition very slowly, starting around that date. And so there were very few of us that were really doing research around that time. Hepatology was dominated by viral hepatitis and other things. And it all started there. And the fact that we observed this clinical observation in our patients, the fact we work in a hospital where we have a very large diabetes clinic, lipid clinic, obesity clinic, and those patients were investigated by us for different aspects of dysregulation of liver function, whether liver enzymes, the presence of steatosis. That became something of interest to us and also to the other specialists that were in charge of these patients, that were managing, taking care of these patients. And because we expressed interest in that, they started to send us these patients for further hepatological investigation. And then we realized that there is a very strong connection in terms of pathophysiological terms between the liver injury and the metabolic dysfunction, which was at that time more or less called the metabolic syndrome, in any case, insulin resistance, all the clinical phenotype that goes around that. And there was a very strong connection between that and the liver injury. And that, of course, triggered a lot of research. And then obviously one thing leading to another, we started to investigate that really closely, build a research program around that. And around 15 years ago, the pharmaceutical industry started getting interested in this disease as well. And then the first attempts at developing drugs for this condition started. And that brought us into a whole other era of doing clinical trials in terms of therapeutic trials for this disease, and so on and so forth. And also, obviously, around that time, a lot of many teams in the world with highly competent experts started looking into this disease, either studying the epidemiology, the natural history, the way to diagnose it, the non-invasive diagnosis, and also the pathophysiology. And that's then it became one of the major themes of research in hepatology that is nowadays. So it was a gradual process. But for sure, the fact that there is a real clinical observation, that there is a real clinical connection to other diseases, that, by the way, goes both ways, maybe we'll talk about that, makes it that it became something very interesting to study.
Thank you. I think that sets the scene perfectly. Now, there's a lot for us to talk about, but I wanted to start by touching on the updated subclassification of steatotic liver disease that was published in June 2023, and that came with the nomenclature change from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and non-alcoholic steatohepatitis to MASLD and MASH. You were a part of the consensus group that produced the update, so I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about why it was needed.
There was a problem with the way this this disease was defined and labeled from the very beginning. The initial observation was that there is a histopathological image when you do a biopsy and you look at what's in the liver of these patients that is very resemblant to alcoholic liver disease. Although these patients did not drink alcohol, or if they did so, it was in very low amounts that could not explain the liver injury, that pathological image. And therefore, the disease was called non-alcoholic. So at that time, it was appropriate because that was simply a visual observation and nobody really understood why this disease is there and where is it coming from. However, as we started doing all these years of research, it became clear that the problem these patients have is not that they don't drink alcohol, is that they have insulin resistance. They have overweight or obesity, diabetes, lipotoxicity, and that's what damages the liver. It turns out that the type of lesions that are created by these constellation of problems that is at the root of the disease is very similar, morphologically speaking, to alcoholic liver disease, but the similarity stops here. And then it became totally inappropriate and problematic to still call these people non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So it would make much more sense to call a disease by what it is rather than by what it is not, knowing that there are clear ways to, of course, for the diagnosis, to exclude those people that have significant amounts of alcohol. So that was the first point. The fact that there was a strong discrepancy between the knowledge we had now with a lot of indications and from all sorts of experimental models that explain that the problem of the disease is insulin resistance, while we're still calling it non-alcoholic and did not recognize in the name the root of the problem, pathophysiologically speaking. That, of course, created some misunderstanding with patients who always heard the alcoholic part, but not always the non-alcoholic part of the name. And they were stunned and sometimes offended that we could label them alcoholics when, in fact, that's not what we did. But there was a miscommunication at that level as well. And we also felt that it's not a very efficient way to inform people, societies, patients, organizations, political bodies about this disease and the public health burden if you don't call it by the right name. The second problem that was also obvious is that if you say non-something, that means that it is an exclusionary diagnosis. It turns out that many patients can have the whole metabolic phenotype with overweight, dyslipidemia, hypertension, but still drink alcohol, not in huge amounts, otherwise they will be labeled alcoholic liver disease, but a bit above the threshold that was usually considered for the diagnosis of this disease, which is nothing or mild. So many people actually in the real world drink moderate amount of alcohol, probably not sufficient to induce pure alcoholic liver disease, but sufficient to induce severe liver damage if associated with the dysmetabolic part. And then these patients were nowhere in the classification. They were in a black hole. They weren't left in any place that would allow them to build cohorts, to be part of those cohorts, to be part of research, either diagnostic or therapeutic. So by doing this classification, we tried to fill up that gap as well. So those were the reasons why we did that. There's a third reason, which is more contentious, less consensual, I would say. Some people agree with it, others disagree, which is a stigma fact. So for English-speaking individuals, some felt that calling a disease, even though it's not a person that you call fatty, but a disease that's called fatty, might induce some level of stigma. And there are some studies that have indicated, that suggested at least, that some patients might feel this as stigmatizing. It's not true for all cultures. It's not true for all languages. It doesn't translate the same way in non-English languages. So not everybody agrees on that, but that was another reason to find a medical term that is more neutral and doesn't include the word fatty. So those are the main reasons. And also the fact that the disease has reached important proportions epidemiologically and also in terms of healthcare burden. And at the same time, now we start to have drugs that could influence the natural history of the disease, efficient drugs on the market. So for all these reasons, we felt that it is time that we correct the imperfections of the first nomenclature in the ways I explained.
Looking at the name change in a bit more detail, I was wondering whether MASLD and NAFLD and MASH and NASH could be considered as the same. Does one equal the other, or are there differences that we need to be aware of?
Yes, very important question. So the short answer is they're equivalent. Now, one of the things we were concerned about by setting up a new set of criteria for the disease is to do it in such a way that, first of all, it represents the clinical phenotype that we see in practice. So it's sort of, it reflects the underlying problem, which is metabolic dysfunction. That's why the metabolic risk factors were chosen at the basis of the definition. That's one thing. The second thing, and of course, when you do that, is you are facing two problems. First, you have to be sensitive enough and specific enough. And sometimes these two things need to be compromised, one versus the other. You don't want to include patients who are too mild, I would say, in a certain way, and you want to be specific enough not to include everybody. And that is difficult to strike that balance. But I think that the main concern was to strike a balance that would allow to not leave anyone behind. So everybody, so the maximum people that were labeled as being NAFLD with the historical definition would also be identified with a new definition. And that for obvious reasons, because many people feared that if we change the definition, and therefore if the two populations are not superposable, are no longer overlapping, and if many people would have qualified with the older definition, but not with the new one, that would raise many problems in terms of diagnostic modalities, in terms of validating the diagnostic modalities, the non-invasive markers, and in terms of clinical trials. Because at that time, many of these therapeutic trials were ongoing already. And then you don't want to have a disease defined in a very different way from what the definition used to put these patients in a trial. So there's a lot to discuss around that, but the bottom line is that the way the elements of these definitions were chosen makes it that these populations are 99% identical. And this was tested empirically by looking back at the cohorts of patients we had, either epidemiological cohorts of patients or cohorts of patients that were used for a non-invasive test qualification, validation at least, or people included in clinical trials, and the 99% overlap has been confirmed in all these situations. So we can confidently say that basically what we did is to streamline the definition in such a way that it gives a solid underlying foundation for the disease, pathophysiologically speaking. So you need to have metabolic risk factors that are a reflection of the metabolic dysregulation. So a positive definition. And by doing that, I think we capture the whole spectrum of the disease. And the 1% of people who are not recognized with a new definition are, in fact, people who had steatosis, no metabolic risk factors whatsoever. So therefore, most probably, steatosis that is not due to the same cause as the one that causes NASH or MASH. So I think it's a very good step towards that. Now, of course, you can then argue, and that's an important, it's a little bit maybe too specialized, but you have to make the distinction between terms that are used for the definition, for defining the person and labeling, yes, he has disease, no, he doesn't have. And then which one of these parameters are the ones that predict a severe course of the disease? And that's so prognosis versus diagnosis. And that's a totally different question. So not all of the metabolic risk factors that have an equal weight in the definition also have an equal weight in terms of prognosis, but that's okay. What we were interested in is first to have a way to define this population based on sane principles rooted in the pathophysiology of the disease.
That's great. Thank you. I was also wondering whether the evidence of equivalence means that the updated nomenclature will be widely accepted and everyone will move forward with the new terms.
Yeah. So for sure, the demonstration that you have this 99% overlap makes it that, honestly, all studies made with non-invasive biomarkers don't need to be repeated with a new definition. Okay. So I believe that should be fine and it's no longer a point to argue about. What is surprising is that when you read the document, the summary product specification characteristics of resmetirom, which is an official document put forth by the FDA once the resmetirom was approved, there is no issue about changing names or whatsoever. So that, while a lot of people fear that that might be a problem, at least for the label of these drugs once they get approved, I personally don't see a problem so far. And I think that's fine. And also, by the way, it is important to understand that when you do a clinical trial, therapeutic, I mean, you select beforehand a set of inclusion criteria, and you can do what you want. You can select them the way you want. You're not tied to a particular definition. So if you want to include 1, 2, 3 metabolic risk factors, you do it the way you want. So that gives you the possibility to work within a definition in a way that is not jeopardized by the definition itself. So that shouldn't be a problem for clinical trials at all.
It's great that you've mentioned resmetirom, because I obviously want to talk about the very exciting publication of the phase 3 trial data earlier this year, followed shortly by the accelerated approval of resmetirom by the US FDA. I wondered if you could give us some of the highlights of that trial.
So I would like to give you some historical highlights first, because we're very happy that this trial was first completed, which is not an easy thing to do with 2,000 so patients. And over a long period of time. And by the way, the trial is ongoing for clinical benefit. So it's a very complex thing. Folks at Madrigal were very talented to be able to push through this successfully. But there were other attempts before. And unfortunately, with the same number of patients, the same amount of effort involved on the part of the sponsor and the investigators, and unfortunately unsuccessful. So there was elafibranor, completed a very large phase 3 trial, unfortunately failed to show it. There was obeticholic acid with the REGENERATE trial, which completed a 7-year trial. First ones who did that. And the trial is entirely positive. Unfortunately, the risk of it was considered too high by the regulatory agency in the US, so the drug is not approved. But that was a major undertaking by Intercept. And now we have the results of that trial in terms of clinical benefit. And the results were just presented at the Digestive Disease Week in the United States. There is, as we have thought, there is a reduction in progression to cirrhosis in people who are taking this drug over 5 or 6 years, which is a major result. And we hope and we're very confident that this will also be the case with resmetirom. But that's good, because that tells you that probably the whole paradigm that was put forth by doing these trials, which is that you first improve several histological aspects of the disease, NASH resolution, fibrosis improvement, and that will result, if you keep treating those patients long enough, with enough high numbers in each arm, in a reduction in progression to cirrhosis. Once you have reduction in progression to cirrhosis, I think you're fine, because then the clinical benefit will follow. But obviously, it will take another 5 to 10 years to have clinical benefit. So the concept wasn't wrong. Now you have to find the right drug that does it fast enough and strong enough so that you can see the result after 1 or 2 years of treatment, and a drug that is well tolerated so that the patient can take it for a long time.
Thank you for putting the progress in context of what's gone before. So what is it about resmetirom that's so encouraging?
Resmetirom seems to have that profile. Excellent tolerability profile, very few side effects, very safe, easy to take, oral drug. And it obviously had a beneficial effect both on the inflammatory part of the disease, so improving activity and improving fibrosis. Honestly, and after only 1 year of treatment, with a clear difference versus placebo. And also, very interestingly, probably a mode of action, at least a biological action that is limited to the liver. There is improvement in the lipid profile, which is a good thing for these patients because they're still at risk of cardiovascular events, and any additional protection is good, but no other effects outside the liver, which is very good, because we need a strong liver-directed drug for this disease, and resmetirom seems to be a very good possibility for that. Also, we have learned some very interesting things from this trial, which is, again, positive for both histological surrogate endpoints. And those things that were that if you treat steatohepatitis and you're able to improve the activity of the disease and make steatohepatitis, I would say, fast disappear, then you will have improvement of fibrosis. You have to wait a bit, but improvement of fibrosis will come. And if you wait even longer, probably there will be less progression of the disease towards cirrhosis. Remains to be seen with resmetirom, but I don't see why this won't be the case as it was with obeticholic acid. That's what we learned. So improvement of steatohepatitis, of the activity comes first, and it's predicting or heralding the improvement in fibrosis. The other thing we've learned is that the stronger the effect on liver fat, the stronger the anti-steatogenic potency of the drug. And this can be measured very precisely with MRI techniques. The highest proportion of improvement in steatohepatitis, and hopefully also of fibrosis later. So we've learned that taking away the fat from the liver, the good fat and mostly the bad fat, makes it that there's less signals for inflammation in the liver and therefore less reasons for the liver to become fibrotic. And those are very important things that needed to be validated through a trial in humans. And all this has been learned from this study.
Have you learned anything else that's notable about resmetirom?
Now, what is interesting, though, is that this drug clearly has beneficial effects for the liver, but it doesn't make you lose weight. So in the beginning, we said that at the root of the disease is overweight, which induces hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, and then lipotoxicity. So here you improve the disease without improving the condition and actually without improving insulin resistance, just by alleviating the inflammatory aspect in the liver and the progression to fibrosis. So therefore, the question becomes, okay, is that enough? Or do we also need to make these patients lose weight to improve the metabolic condition of this patient? So again, resmetirom improves the lipid profile in a very strong and across the board for most atherogenic particles. But there's still the insulin resistance, glycemic dysregulation, and overweight, which are still there. Now, there are other ways to treat that. And maybe it's unreasonable to ask one drug to treat everything. But that is an open question, especially since now we have drugs such as the incretins, the GLP-1 analogs, which are able to act on the metabolic side and weight loss side and certainly improve some aspects in the liver. We'll have to wait to see for fibrosis. But that opens the whole field of thinking of what is important for the patient, how this should be managed, in what order, what potency, and so on.
Absolutely. I was going to ask about combination treatments and whether that's something to be investigated, targeting different aspects of the condition, and whether that might have a synergistic effect. Is combination treatment something you can imagine being progressed, or would it just be too difficult to address in clinical trials?
Yes, it's extremely complex, and we should not rush into fantasies about combination therapies without really looking at all the different aspects that need to be taken into account. For instance, one of the aspects is who treats which patient in what country and how do different countries differ. And that's a major aspect because where I work, people like to go to different specialists. And if there's a heart problem, they're not going to come to me. If they have diabetes, they're not going to come to me. They're going to go to the cardiologist and then to the diabetologist. And if there's renal insufficiency, they also have a nephrological consult. And that's how things are organized here in terms of healthcare access. I can imagine that in other countries, things can be different. I can imagine that at different levels, for instance, primary versus tertiary care, things can also be grouped differently. But this needs to be taken into account. And, patient preferences needs to be taken into account too. If I were a patient with this type of comorbidities, for sure, I would like to have the best cardiologist, the best diabetologist, and the best hepatologist, but not just one of them to treat all the other diseases. I won't feel comfortable, maybe for good or bad reasons, but that's how it is. So you have to be very careful in addressing all these things. I know there's a lot of talk about holistic approaches. What needs to be done is that for sure, is that one patient needs to be all these aspects being taken care of. That for sure. And here we are at a disadvantage because the liver part of the equation was almost always forgotten by our colleagues who considered until maybe 5-10 years ago that steatosis is a benign condition and you shouldn't worry. And then if you have steatosis, you have a little bit of increased aminotransferases, but that's not a big deal. So there's a lot of work in terms of increasing disease awareness, and that for sure is very important. But as long as each comorbidity is well taken care of, that is already the minimum that we need to do. Now, if you have a drug that treats everything, a poly pill that treats absolutely everything at the same time, great. The problem then becomes, from a scientific clinical research point of view, how to demonstrate that. And if you want to rigorously demonstrate that a combination is better than a monotherapy, there are some regulatory issues you need to take into account in the way you conduct these trials. And those trials get awfully complicated if you really want to follow those strict guidelines that would allow you to say methodologically beyond reasonable doubt that a combination is worth it versus the monotherapy. And just to tell you about the difficulty of that, when you have standard of care, drug A, drug B, and you want to show that drug A plus B is better than anything else, you have to show that drug A plus B is better than placebo for sure. But you also have to show that A plus B is better than A alone or B alone, and actually much better to justify the additional cost or side effects. And that's not easy. That takes very large trials, long follow-up, big number of patients, and it's complicated. And then a way to diagnose and measure treatment effect that does not rely on liver biopsy, because it would be very impractical to do these very large trials with liver biopsy. But now what people can argue is that we already have combinations, because some of the drugs that are also candidates for treating NASH are already on the market. So if we have resmetirom, for instance, now we could very easily envision that some patients, whether on purpose, by design, will be treated with both, or it so happens that someone's already on a GLP-1 and then you put him on resmetirom, so all of a sudden you have a combination. But that is not the same as clinically validating a combinatorial regimen. So therefore, you need to be very careful. See, there's different levels of thinking here. And of course, on a pragmatic level, some people will end up having two drugs that are potentially treating NASH. Then you get into a different level of difficulty, is that those patients that were on a GLP-1 receptor agonist for diabetes or for obesity, and that will be put on resmetirom. The reason they're put on resmetirom is that the disease was still there despite them being on the GLP-1 analogs. Let's say GLP-1 targeting anything in particular, but that's an example because they're already on the market. So that means that you also have to take into account when you talk combination, when do you start the combination? Are you talking a combination de novo when you don't know if a patient will respond to any of these drugs, or are you talking to a combination, sort of an add-on therapy, to patients that are already on a drug but are obviously not responding sufficiently to that drug? So it's a very different situation than a combination where you treat from the beginning with two different drugs, see how this works. So they're clearly non-responders for each one of these drugs. And adding something on top of that, it's a different type of combination than the one people have in mind when they talk about, there's two drugs, let's combine them.
Returning to the phase 3 trial of resmetirom, patients had moderate to severe NASH but had not progressed to cirrhosis. One other thing I wanted to ask is about treatments for cirrhosis and whether you think they are beyond our reach.
Yes, so that is a very important problem. And obviously, there are many trials ongoing for people with cirrhosis. There were some trials before and they all failed. So it won't be easy to have a successful cirrhosis trial. One of the difficulties, and everybody wants to do a cirrhosis trial because there is an unmet clinical need, so scientifically it's understandable. Also because that's where most of the benefit can come for the patient, but also for the company that sells the drug. Because obviously, the closer you are to a clinical event, the more value the drug has, if it's efficient. So everybody wants to go into cirrhosis trials. The problem with cirrhosis trials, to make it simple, is that you can look at two different things, and those two things are not quite compatible in the same population. You can look at reversal of fibrosis. So someone has cirrhosis, but you're able somehow, based on the antifibrotic effects we've seen with resmetirom, with OCA, with obeticholic acid, to reverse that fibrotic process, although even though it is at the cirrhotic stage. Is there any benefit knowing that somehow cirrhosis is still there and you can't reverse all the features of cirrhosis? Maybe you do reverse fibrosis if you're successful, maybe some other features, but not all of them. So is that going to give you a clinical benefit? Very few data. There's some data that indicate that it might be the case. And if you think about it, that seems sort of natural and understandable. And then there's another thing you may want to do with cirrhosis population when you treat it with a drug is to treat them in such a way that they don't progress towards decompensation. Because the problem with, of course, when you die of cirrhosis, you can die of liver cancer, but you also mostly die of decompensation. So proving that a drug will reduce the incidence of decompensating events is probably the hardest part to prove. Why is it hard to prove? It's because this is still a disease that evolves very slowly, and those trials will need to be very long in terms of duration and also have to include a lot of patients. The difficulty here is that people that might be amenable to fibrosis regression and those in whom progression of the disease towards clinical events can be stopped, they're not the same. In order to have fibrosis regression, you would need to have very early cirrhosis. In order to be able to prove less clinical events, you need to study a population of cirrhotics at a very advanced stage. Otherwise, you'll have to wait 15 years in your trial, which is not possible. So therefore, the populations where you can see these effects are different. You would almost need to have two cirrhosis trials, one directed at fibrosis reversal, the other directed at inhibiting clinical progression of the disease. That makes it highly impractical. And that's one of the difficulties these trials face. Another difficulty is that as much as the disease process could be seen as linear activity in the early stages, the activity will build up fibrosis, that builds up fibrosis, and then you can try to reverse that. As much as that is true in the early stages of the disease, it is no longer true at the late stages of disease where people with cirrhosis, when they reach the decompensating state, when they start having the clinical complications, it's not necessarily only about fibrosis progression. It is about a lot of other things. You look at factors that precipitate hemodynamic changes, variceal hemorrhage, encephalopathy, infections, renal impairment, bacterial translocation. All these things have their own life in terms of pathophysiology, in terms of pathogenesis, once you reach the cirrhotic stage. So a drug that would be efficient for treating lipotoxicity, for instance, treating activity, inflammatory aspect of NASH, or the fibrotic progression of disease might not be sufficiently efficient to control for the hemodynamic response, to control for endothelial dysfunction, to control for bacterial translocation, to control for the gut-brain interactions that cause encephalopathy. And therefore, other modes of action might be necessary if you want to prevent the occurrence of those clinical complications. So can a drug, even though it's a good anti-MASH drug, a good antifibrotic, also achieve those particular objectives? That's a very big challenge to us from a single agent. So that's what makes these cirrhosis trials very difficult, but also, of course, that what would make the biggest reward in terms of impact for a patient.
So when is the ideal time to start treatment? Is it as early as possible so people never progress to NASH and then onto cirrhosis? And if so, is there more that we need to be doing or could be doing to identify them?
Just to pick up on this, yes and no. The best treatment is prevention. So you don't have the disease. You do healthy diet, physical exercise, that's the best treatment prevention. The problem if you treat too early is that many patients will not progress or very slowly. And that is a big problem in terms of drug development because you need to see the results and you need to have a return on the investment soon, not 40 years later. So if you can't treat people too early because of the uncertainty about progression of the disease, the variability in the natural course of the disease in each individual, especially if you want to treat it too early with drugs that are very expensive and have some side effects, that won't work. So you can't treat them too early. You have to treat them once the fibrosis started being built in the liver. Not too late, because if you're at cirrhotic stage, unless you have a good cirrhotic drug, it won't work anymore. So yes, there is an interval there. Now, in order to have a good management of that, you will need, first of all, as you said, in your question, to identify the right moment where the disease is, the right stage of the disease. And then you would need to have tools to identify a progression, because you see someone at an early stage, you say, well, it's too early to treat, but then I'm going to follow him and see if he progresses, then I'll start treatment. But how do you follow him? Do you have good ways to monitor progression? Are they sensitive enough? Are they specific enough? So that raises a lot of other problems. The consensus right now is that people who started having fibrosis in a moderate amount should be candidates for therapy. And then we'll see from going on from there what the benefit is and how strong the effect is. There are some drugs that suggest in much smaller phase two trials, unless you have a phase three trial, I can't say anything, but from phase two trials suggest that there's a very strong antifibrotic benefit. I'm referring, for instance, to FGF21 compounds. Then the terms of the equation might change as far as who we're going to treat at what stage of the disease. But that remains to be confirmed in larger phase three trials.
It's been so interesting to talk to you today about everything. Just to finish up, I was wondering what things you think we should be looking out for in the next few years in terms of diagnosis, monitoring, or treatment.
I think there's a lot of research being done in non-invasive tests to replace the liver biopsy, both for patient management every day in the real world and for clinical trials. And that is actually a huge effort, because if you want those methods to be qualified by the regulatory agencies, then you need to do that if you only use them in clinical trials instead of doing the biopsies, it ultimately benefits patients. That's a very long process, regulatory qualification. So this can only be done through very large consortia. There was one in Europe called Litmus. There's another one that's active in the US called Nimble. We need to have a follow-up for these consortia so that these efforts can be continued towards successful and final qualification of these biomarkers. And then there's a lot of movement in that space. The other thing that needs to be done, obviously, is to raise awareness of the disease. As simply as putting into people's minds the fact that when you are a person with diabetes, you have to check for everything that's already in the textbooks, the eye, the kidney, neuropathy system, and everything else, glucose control. But you also have to check the liver. And that very simple message is still not in every textbook of diabetes. So we need people to be aware of that. And we need good circuits, good pathways from primary care to specialized centers in order to monitor these patients and diagnose first and monitor them. And then, of course, drug development. In order for drug development to be successful, you need two things. Well, three things, investors. You need the money. You need to be able to do these trials fast enough to not to have to rely on the liver biopsy for patient selection and for measuring treatment effect. And then you need patient participation. So therefore, I think there's a lot of education we need to do in the general public. And that's not specific for this disease, obviously. But there is still a lot of reluctance in the general public to participate in a clinical trial. So people need to be told what a clinical trial is about, what are the ethical safeguards, the technical safeguards in terms of potential toxicity, how all this was very carefully looked at by the regulatory agencies, the ethical committees, before it gets to a patient signature. And this is very important because when you do everyday therapeutic trials, you realize that a lot of this can be improved in order to have more trial participation and in better conditions.
That's wonderful. Thank you again for taking the time to speak with me. It feels like such a great time for the field, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens next.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals for their ongoing medical education and entertainment. It should not replace the professional advice of a doctor or pharmacist and may not be used as a basis for diagnosis or any change to the prescribed treatment of disease. The views expressed by our moderators and guests are their opinions and do not represent the position of any third parties. The information given in the podcast is subject to change as the scientific field and clinical advances progress.